Good morning, everyone. And I will call this Property Tax Relief and Local Sales Tax Division meeting to order. And we'll get going right away. I see Representative Eakin out there with House File 242. If you would care to come forward, bring your witnesses along. We do not have a quorum yet, so we will not be able to make a motion to put your bill before us, but we'll do that when we have the quorum, even if it's after your testimony today, Representative.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We are here today to try to continue something that we passed last year in the tax bill. There is a casino called the Shooting Star Casino located up near Menomon, Minnesota. It for many years was on the property tax rolls and provided a significant amount of property taxes for the county, the city, and the school district. And recently the tribe has put that, or is in the process of putting that casino into a trust, which takes it off of the property tax rolls, which is a major hit, especially for the county of Menomon and also for the city and the school district. But the county was the one that was affected the greatest by that. And the legislature last year, we did pass a bill in the tax bill, which did provide assistance to all three, the county, the city, and the school district. And about $450,000 to the county, $80,000 to the city, $70,000 to the school district. And it was anticipated that the school district and the city would eventually not need this assistance because, of course, the formula would change because of the loss of property tax base. And it was assumed that that the county would be the one that would need continuing assistance because the formula does not readjust and make up for the loss of that revenue. There is, however, an appeals process taking place, so the casino has not officially been placed in trust as of yet, and as a result, the school district and the city the formula change has not taken place, so they're still out that money, and as a result, we do have in this bill continuing aid for them as well. The same amount, $70,000 for the school district, $80,000 for the city, and again $450,000 for the county. If I can, I'd like to just turn it over to my testifiers next. We have with us today the Menomon Treasurer and Auditor Frank Thompson, and also County Commissioner Wally Ide, who came all the way down from Menomon today to testify. So, thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative. And it was better coming down this Friday than it would have been last Friday when we had to cancel. But welcome, and if you'd state your name and proceed.
Good morning, Chairman. My name is Wallace Ide. I'm a commissioner in Menomon County.
And I'm Frank Thompson, the Menomon County Auditor.
Okay. Please proceed.
I would ask that the county auditor give you a little background there to be prepared.
Okay.
Yep, we have a
Mr.
short narrative
Thompson.
Here.
And if you'd move the mic a little closer to you. Thank you.
All right, is that better? Good morning, and thank you for taking the time to listen to Menomon County's struggles. Menomon County is a small county located in northwestern Minnesota. It was established in 1906 after the original tribal treaties of 1837 and 1867 were signed. The county is 563 square miles with an estimated population of just over 5,100 residents. Menomon County has the distinction of being the only county in the state of Minnesota that lies entirely within the boundaries of an Indian reservation, which is the White Earth Indian Reservation. Approximately 25% of the land in Menomon County is already tax exempt for various federal, state, and tribal reasons. Menomon County is a poor county. Menomon County already has the highest tax rate of any county in the state. Menomon County's distinction of having the highest tax rate comes from the data compiled prior to the casino applying for trust status. Menomon County has one of the highest unemployment rates of any county in the state, compounded with a very low, if not the lowest, per capita income of any county in the state. Menomon County has a 23.3% highest rate of children living in poverty of any other county. We have the highest rate of public assistance payments per capita of any county, at roughly $914 in Minoman County versus $535 in Ramsey County. Minoman County is not just already impoverished, it has the distinction of being the most impoverished in the state. But these facts and figures are based on historical data. The problem is that the future looks worse for Minoman because the county has the responsibility to provide programs and services to address its citizens' needs as best it can. The county has received notice from the United States Department of the Interior, Bureau of Indian Affairs, that our single largest taxpayer, the Shooting Star Casino, has been approved for trust status, pending appeal, and that will remove the casino from the property tax rolls that we already have a reduced land base. The casino properties being removed from the Minoman County tax rolls would result in a devastating financial impact on an already impoverished county. For example, in 2006, it amounted to a total of $932,000 in lost property taxes, which is 18% of our total 2006 taxes billed to taxpayers in the county. The direct financial impact on Minoman County's share of this property tax is of roughly $456,000. What this means to the county in 2007 is that we will again have to find a way to cut our budgets that were already established and set by the county board. Minoman County has historically done their best to operate in a very frugal manner. Several county employees and staff wear many different hats to maintain its efficiencies. Our budgets have virtually no room for cuts and reductions. Many of our services are mandated by statute and will be extremely difficult, if not impossible, to continue these levels of services that we are responsible to provide. Minoman County has historically had the highest average property tax rate of any in the state. This is because our taxable land base is smaller and the tax burden is spread among fewer landowners. To further illustrate the tax rate concerns, consider the statewide net tax capacity rate for Minoman County in 2004 was 112.98%. Minoman County's net tax capacity rate for 2006 was the highest in the state at 174%. With the casino being removed from the tax rolls, the average tax capacity rate would skyrocket to an unprecedented amount of 196.874%. The remaining county taxpayer residents simply can't afford this. We need to fill this hole. If we were unsuccessful in filling this hole, Minoman County will experience a devastating impact on the taxes due on real property, especially within the city of Minoman, where the casino lies. The typical average home in the city of Minoman will see a tax increase of approximately 40%. This tax rate would affect the sales of homes in our area, which would further impact the ability to provide the services required of county residents. Outside the city limits of Minoman, the remaining county landowners would experience a tax rate increase varying from 8% to 24%. Simply stated, Minoman County needs your continuing help. Last year, Minoman County, in conjunction with the city of Minoman and the local school district, we were appropriated $600,000 of aid from the state's general fund to compensate for lost tax revenue from the casino. That appropriation was both necessary and much appreciated. The problem is that the uncollectible taxes from the casino is unfortunately an annual problem, which requires an annual solution. Accordingly, Minoman County requests the $600,000 aid from the state to become an annual appropriation. The aid is direly needed and will be used solely to offset otherwise uncollectible lost tax revenue. Your consideration for this ongoing funding is of urgency for all taxpayers of our county. Your help today will be of the utmost importance for all affected parties. Thank you once again for sharing in our plight.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. And Mr. Commissioner?
Yes, sir.
Have some comments?
The problem we face is because the trust application for the casino that affects the $450,000 county, it has to remain on the tax roll, and we have to use that figure when we work with our budget, knowing that it's not going to be coming in. And working on it and still trying to project some type of a budget, knowing we're not going to get the $450,000 this year, we're going to end up about 300 and some thousand short in the general revenue fund, and a portion going into road and bridge and a portion into human services of the $450,000. The commissioners have been reluctant, well, we haven't been able to deal with developments or improvements. Road and bridge is getting hurt bad. We've had equipment failure that we've had to sideline. Even our equipment budget that comes out of the CASA money is not enough to offset what we need for replacement. As far as street county roads, the only thing we're doing is now minimum gravel. And when I say minimum, it's not even a workhorse of gravel. But the money isn't there. We've put a freeze on all capital purchases, and we've done that for about 3 years now, and that's going to come back to haunt us. Eventually, we've got to buy equipment, and the money isn't there. As people retire, we strive not to replace if we can remove that person from the staff. We have departments that have two people, the elected official and one person, and sometimes that's a part-time person. We just can't get any more bare bones. And we need to do some major capital improvements in the county. Some of that are kind of mandated, like Department of Corrections. We've got a jail that in 10 months will be closed, and we have to do improvements on it or build a new one. By the loss of the casino, our bonding capacity has dropped so that we can't bond for maybe more than $2 million. Yet we can't put all our eggs in one basket at the jail because the hospital needs improvements. We need to come up with some way to put in senior housing with services because we have not one single assisted living unit in the county and equipment for the office workers, and the money isn't there. And until the federal government makes a decision as to the final status of the trust, we have to carry those figures on our books and include it when we try and build a budget.
Thank you, Commissioner. Or do you have
no, that's
okay. Thank you so much.
If you have questions, I'll be happy to.
Any questions for Commissioner Ide or Mr. Thompson? Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm being new to this committee. I see that this was approved in the past. This is curious to me. Maybe it's just because I'm new, but the federal government's going to take this property and take it off the tax rolls, and the state's supposed to step in and pay the bill. Mr. Chair, testifies, am I missing something here? It seems like something's. And the other thing, question I have, if there's still a question as to whether they will pay the tax and the tribe is refusing to pay now, will they have to go back and back pay that for what they haven't paid in 06 and what you're assuming to be 07? Is this new precedent? Is this something that happens regularly? I'd need to be enlightened, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Demmer. Last year was a one-time. Last year it was one-time for $600,000, and it's not too unlike what we dealt with Representative Wolschlager's bill the other day, where you have a drop in tax base, although different circumstances, you've got a drop in tax base. And this one's federal, more federal, where the other one was more state, but it's somewhat similar. I don't know as far as the precedents on all of this and how often we've dealt with this in the past. Would you, staff, do you care to chime in here?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, one thing we have to keep in mind is this is the only casino that has been on the tax rolls. All of the rest of the casinos in Minnesota have been in trust status, and so and I think it's because it's been of ownership and receivership, right? And maybe the county can talk a little bit more about that. But so this has been on the tax rolls as the only casino. And so now they've applied for trust status, and so the issue is dealing with that. And if it was in a county and or location where it wasn't such a large part of the tax base, it probably wouldn't be such a big issue. But it happens to be in a county and in a community where it is a huge part of the tax base, and so it becomes a lot bigger issue than it typically would.
And if I could, Representative Demmer, Representative Demmer, then we.
Okay, the question I have, I guess, Ms. Baker, then. Any of the other casinos in the state, do we make payments to any of the other counties or cities in lieu of the property taxes that those other casinos would have been paying?
Ms. Baker?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Demmer, no. There are some in-lieu payments that some of the tribes make to counties and cities. We did some work and some study on that, but, you know, to my knowledge, the state doesn't per se make. We have different agreements with cigarette and liquor and some of those, but as far as property tax payments, we don't have payments per se.
And if I could...
But, well, no, what I was going to say is, though, is because it's off the tax base is lower, and so it, you know, and once this gets pulled off the tax base, you know, it self-corrects in local government aid and in school aid in that you have lower, you have a higher need because you have a lower tax base. So to that degree, property tax comes in through those formulas. But it's the county, I think, in this particular situation that is really the governmental agency that, or the governmental subdivision that is the one that is hurting the most, because the school district and city will be pretty much self-correct, or for the large part, it will.
Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Demmer, and thank you for your comments, Ms. Baker. This is a very unique situation, and as Auditor Thompson had already talked about, Manoman County already has the highest property tax rate in the state. It's one of the poorer counties in the state. This was a huge part of the property tax base that's been lost here. And that was recognized last year in the emergency legislation that was passed for the tax bill. And Representative Abrams was very understanding of the uniqueness of the situation there, and it was very helpful in getting that passed. So I think we need to recognize that this is a situation unlike any other that's been faced in the state. And I think we also need to recognize, although this it's obviously because the tribal lands are being placed into a trust, which is a federal issue, but it's still a state issue because the counties and the city and the school districts obviously are arms of the state. And Ms. Baker had already said that to a large degree, the city and the school district are self-correcting, but not so for the county. And the county has some very heavy responsibilities, not just to a part of Manoman County, but the whole county, including the tribe, and services that they have to provide for their citizens. And we want to make sure they're able to do that.
Representative Lincheski.
I just wanted to add a little history on this bill for members who may not have tracked it. Representative Eakin and I worked on this, and Representative Abrams was very supportive. Representative Lanning is familiar with this, as was Representative Simpson. In the Tax Conference Committee, we had a great deal of discussion about this problem, and members should understand that this was incredibly unique. It was similar to when we've given more assistance to communities that have been hit by floods. Really, they lost their tax base kind of overnight. And so we did do a one-time, a one-year provision, but I think we all knew that we always intended to make it permanent. It was just a matter of the spreadsheet at that time. But for members just trying to understand it, it's eventually, as Ms. Baker said, the aid programs will sort of pick up as the tax base, the LGA formulas will come into play here. But last year, it was really the school district that was going to see the biggest hit. Now it's the county portion, and I think while it seems unique to members, we certainly do, we have a history, whether it's floods or particular cities being hit with certain things when they really lose most of their, half their tax base overnight in trying to provide transition aid in a way to get them to that point. So I think it's fair to say that all the conferees felt it was something that had to be done in a very bipartisan way in both the House and Senate. So it was a very unique. This is the Shooting Star Casino, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And so this one particular area was hit very hard. And so I would encourage members to think through the need to get this into your division report, Mr. Chair, because it's going to be an ongoing problem, and if we don't solve it, we're going to have to find a way to solve it in the future, as they don't have the tax base, and we can't import people up there to pay taxes overnight. So they're really in a tough situation.
Thank you. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I continue to support this unique situation, the relief that we're providing. Ms. Dalton, could you talk about to what extent this one-time money that we provided this last time impacted local aids at all, either LGA or county aids.
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, there are really two problems going on. One of these problems has to do with, as long as this land is in dispute, it shows up on the tax rolls, they spread the tax, and then they don't get paid the tax. Once it is, you know, the disputed land is settled and it is off, the school aid formula and the LGA formula will start compensating schools and cities for their lost revenue base, and pretty, not 100%, but pretty close. Schools will probably do it very close to 100%. In the cities, it will be, you know, somewhere about 80 to 90%. But there's a one-year lag between when the land finally comes off the tax rolls and when the aid formula and the school levy and aid formulas will actually pick up that difference. On the county side, that is not true. Only half of the county aid is distributed at all based on tax base, and it's not anywhere close to kind of that dollar-for-dollar offset on the county side. And so counties will the county will continue to have a problem because their formula won't pick up kind of that, won't totally compensate them for that lost tax base. So at some point, the school and city program, school and city levy problems will go away once the land, the dispute is settled. It'll go away 1 year after that. The problem for the county will not go away.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Eakin, I was wondering if you would be willing to add some language here. I have some of the same concerns that Representative Demery has, and that I don't want us to be setting a precedence that makes it so that folks that haven't been using trust land in the past, haven't been receiving assistance from the state, that we make sure that that doesn't happen. I mean, based upon what Ms. Baker has described, those are areas that had not had the land on the tax rolls, and so they weren't experiencing a loss of revenue when it went into trust or things like that. And I just want to make sure that those communities don't come back and say, well, hey, if they got it, we want to be able to get some money too. And I was wondering if you'd be willing to put some language that just says that this is, you know, strictly for this area and does not set a precedence for other areas.
Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson. Yeah, I'd be willing to look at such language and discuss whether it's needed. I certainly think, you know, we don't want to start the precedent, like you say, that all these untaxed lands are suddenly going to become compensated for. But we can discuss that. Representative Lencheski had mentioned that this is, again, a unique situation, not unlike a flood or a disaster of some sort. So in some ways, maybe it's already been a precedent that this is a disastrous situation, a unique situation in that regard. So I'm not sure if it's necessary, but I'm certainly willing to look at it and consider it.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I just know that sometimes we lose our institutional knowledge down the road, and so sometimes it's helpful just to kind of spell it out and make sure people that down the road know what our intent was.
Thank you. We do have a quorum now, so would someone care to move this bill? Representative Dietrich moves House File 242 for possible inclusion into the report. Any other questions from the members here? Otherwise, is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against House File 242? Seeing none, Representative Eakin, do you have a closing comment?
Mr. Eide had something that he may want to discuss. What's going on at the federal level? There is some there's some action, or at least consideration being taken at the federal level. So.
Okay. Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman. Part of our problem is that federal government has not, or the Bureau of Indian Affairs and Borough Park and the Interior have not acted on the trust status. That's why it stays there. But we went through the NACO organization, and working with Congressman Colin Peterson, he has the intent of introducing a bill at the federal level that would change the process of putting land into trust, not using only the Department of Interior and the Bureau of Indian Affairs, but would also use a local government agency of the land that it affects. determine if the federal government could give some compensation for the loss of that land, because we have land that is fee land now that they bought in going into trust. To look at it, if it was agricultural land, we know what we're going to lose, but if you buy, put it into trust and develop it into housing, the county incurs a lot more expense. And Colin Peterson feels that the federal government needs to get involved and give the county, whatever county it is, some form of compensation to offset the increased expenses that occur. There's no guarantee that's ever going to fly because we're talking nationwide, but there's hope.
Okay, thank you. Representative Vekin, anything to close on?
I appreciate your consideration here today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The chair will lay over House File 242 for possible inclusion into the division report. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For being
you,
here sir. Today. You bet. Thank you, Representative. Also at this time, Wednesday or Monday, we heard a Representative Bunn's bill on market value homestead credit, but she didn't have a number at the time. So I'd like to entertain a motion on House File 1745. Anyone care to? Representative Paymar moves House File 1745 for possible inclusion in the division report. And with that, I will lay over House File 1745 for the division report. Also, let's do minutes if we can. March 7th minutes, do we hear a motion to approve? Representative Demmer, who I can't believe can think of anything else but the ball game tonight, so I appreciate you here and staying focused, makes the motion to approve of the March 7th minutes. Do I hear any discussion? If not, we have a motion to approve the March 7th minutes. All those in favor say aye. Those opposed say nay. Motion does prevail. At this time, Representative Brown, if you would take the chair.
The next bill we have for consideration is House File 848. Members, the bill summary from the House Research should be a green-colored sheet in your packet, and the fiscal note is in yellow. Representative Marquardt, would you like to move your bill and get it before the committee?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I'd like to move House File 848 for possible inclusion into the division report.
Representative?
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, this is a bill that actually has three components that deals with lowering agricultural property taxes. And you know, one of the largest areas of increase this past year, if you look at the property simulations from 2007, is in agriculture. Statewide, on the average, the increase for 07 is about 12%. And I know Representative Demmer has been working extensively in looking at ways to also lower property tax on agriculture, and this is just an approach to do that. There's three components. I'll go over those. I don't have any testifiers, but I know there's at least one testifier who has some concerns on the first part I'm going to mention. So the first part of the bill deals with homestead. Right now, an owner can still claim homestead, or if you have non-contiguous land, it can still be homesteaded if it's within four townships, basically, or 24 miles. This bill totally eliminates any distance requirements. Now, I know that's not the perfect world, and I mainly throw that out there for discussion on this, because for example, in my district, you might have someone right now living in Moorhead, and their farm might be east of Hawley, and it might be 26 or 27 miles. And I realize maybe we need a distance there, and probably having no distance limit, which means somebody from Minneapolis or St. Paul could be farming. Now, of course, you have to be actively farming, which means being more involved in just management, actually
being there and doing the work and so forth. So that may or may not be a problem if someone could go back, more power to them. But I'm not totally committed to that. But somehow I wanted to put this out for discussion on whether or not four townships, or if there's some other way we can look at that where someone's even within the county, but is further away than 24 miles. And of course, if you qualify for the homestead, there's a difference on the property classification, and it would keep your property taxes lower. The second part to the plan, on that first tier on homestead right now, the classification rate is 0.55. This lowers it to 0.50. And I tell you, there, I do have some very strong philosophical background on that. I just think it's a rounder number. You take it to 0.50, it's simpler, it's easier, and on that first tier, it would probably reduce property taxes by whatever that would be, roughly 10% or so. And in the third part of the plan, ups the homestead credit. Right now, it's 0.3% to $345, which would mean it peaks at $115,000 of valuation. That'd be $345. And then it can go down a maximum of $115 down to $230, and I think that'd be at about $345,000 valuation, and then it levels off. This would take that from 0.3% from $115 up to $150. So your maximum credit would be $450. It keeps the minimum or maximum reduction of $115, so then that would take it to, it takes you out to $380,000, but the $115 minus $450, $335 it would be. So it provides more property tax relief. So those are the three main components, and I would stand for questions, but I do know there's at least one testifier that I think would like to speak, or more. So, I'll turn this over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you state your name for the tape, please?
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Gloria Pinky, and my home address is 9795 170th Street East in Hastings, Minnesota. I'm a manager in the Dakota County Assessor's Office, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, not on behalf of Dakota County. Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, Section 1 does have several things that I would like to comment on, and I was pleased to see that Chair Marquardt is aware of some of those potential problems. And I'd like to spell them out a little bit from our perspective in the assessing profession. This bill, removing the four township limitation for agricultural homesteads, would certainly greatly increase the complexity and the cost to counties for administration of agricultural homesteads. Currently, counties must often coordinate with their adjoining counties that are within the four township limitation. Annually, we must exchange taxable market values, tax capacity, agricultural credit, with each of those counties. Tracking ownership changes, especially with the many transfers to trusts or limited liability companies or partnerships, is another administration problem. I am not able to estimate the potential additional cost to counties, and it certainly will vary by county, but the administration time and potential programming cost could be significant, depending on the number of applicants that would participate in this extended homestead. Right now, we would have to keep track of which county or counties are involved in this extension. We need to know the number of parcels and the actual parcel numbers, which is also another problem because the counties don't have the same parcel numbering format, so that's always kind of a headache. We need to know the number of acres in each of those parcels and in each county. We need to know the Social Security number, so we make sure that we're giving the same person the ag credit and homestead credit that they got where their primary property is located. We need to know if the individual parcel is green acres or not, and that may affect the amount of credit they would get in the home county. The taxable values in the other county must watch the first tier limit, so we may end up with reaching that first tier limit of homestead, which is now 790,000. Some of it would be in one county, some of it could be in multiple counties. I see a problem that could exist on if multiple counties are involved, which county or parcels get the credit first, and who decides that, the property owner, the assessor, or someone else. So that could also be another problem. Historically, Dakota County, which is a metropolitan county, has almost 50% of our land area, which is 14 townships, that are still primarily agricultural use. So we have a vested interest in the outcome of this provision and want to explain as best we can what the impacts might be. In Dakota County, we have only 21 actively engaged in farming applications right now. And we have 22 what we call cross-county homestead applications. And we deal now with four counties. Our adjoining counties are Goodhue, Rice, Scott, and Washington. This bill, as it is right now, and Chair Markwick sees some of the problems that may come with that provision in Section 1. Across county and actively farming applications are very difficult for my colleagues in greater Minnesota to administer because they have many, many more than we do in Dakota County. And removal of the four township limitation will certainly increase those complexities. If this bill passes in its current form, I can envision some of the agricultural homestead property owners in Dakota County or in our adjoining counties applying for homestead on ag land they own somewhere in greater Minnesota. We potentially have people who own and manage a small farm, maybe 40 or 80 or 100 acres in Dakota County where they live, who might also own agricultural land in western or northern parts of Minnesota, and they could get their taxes reduced significantly on their outstate properties. Most likely, the tax capacity of their outstate property is currently calculated at the ag non-homestead rate of 1%. That tax capacity would also be reduced to 0.5% or possibly 0.5% if the provision in Section 2 of House File 848 would pass. In addition, as the first tier of agricultural homesteads now increases annually due to indexing by the Department of Revenue, a greater number of parcels and properties may be eligible for that homestead class rate. I see a problem that could develop with property assessors, my colleagues in greater Minnesota, explaining to taxpayers in, say, Otter Tail County, where Chair Marquardt has a cabin, I believe. Am I correct in that?
I did your research.
I did. explaining to their taxpayers why an 80-acre parcel that's owned, and it's farmed, but it's owned by somebody in Hastings, Minnesota, has half the taxes of somebody who lives in Alexandria but does not qualify for homestead. That would be tough to explain to those local taxpayers, so that's another problem that I hope you will consider. This brings up the issue that I do want you to consider, and that is the tax shift that could occur with this bill. I have no way of estimating how great that shift may be. I haven't a clue how many people might file for it, but I suspect that farmers are quite astute business persons, and if they find a way to reduce their taxes to half by actively farming, they'll figure out a way to do that. That's a significant difference. As you well know, whenever the tax capacity on one property or type of property is reduced in a jurisdiction, other taxpayers in that jurisdiction must pick it up. In the example I mentioned above, the Dakota County farmer would pay less taxes on their property that may be located in Otter Tail County or in the Red River Valley or anywhere in Minnesota, which means the current property owners in that area would pay more. Thank you for your time and consideration, and if there are any questions, I'll try and answer them.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since we're talking about distance separating properties here, it would only seem fair that if we make this a 200-mile swing, that I could include my cabin in my homesteaded property, and that would only be a fair trade-off, I think. What did you say to that? Well, you wouldn't have any problem with that. You don't have any cabins in the court.
We don't have any cabins. I'll defer to the chair. I suspect that would be a major policy change, but...
Representative
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, as you hear, as you could hear, there are some minor problems with Section 1. But, yeah, I'm not going to go that far. And I do appreciate the testimony. And it's just, it's the... Put this out for discussion, and certainly I know this isn't something the members probably want to go, but I think, and maybe the 24 miles is a fair way to go. I mean, I just wondered if there's, it just where it winds up where someone might even be in the same county, and yet it's a little further than 24 miles, and maybe there's something we can do there, but I certainly think I have a feeling of the board here, and so, like I said, it's thrown up for discussion, and there certainly are some concerns, that's for sure.
Representative Anderson? Well, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, I think you'll probably find this odd coming from me since I'm the Metro legislator, but I do understand what you're trying to get at. I know in the, when it comes to ag farming overall, it's becoming harder and harder for farmers to find land that's close to them, especially when folks are moving out into the rural communities and buying up the land that's traditionally been farmed. So I understand your intent, but I also have heard the concerns that Ms. Pinky has expressed. But I think it's good to have the discussion.
And Madam Chair, when I go to the lakes, I don't want to have to answer this question either. I want to relax and maybe get out fishing. And the weather's going to be nice next week also. So.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Representative Marquardt,
that's
you.
That's it. Thank you.
Were there any other testifiers?
Okay. If you could lay over.
Yes. Representative Marquardt, you don't have any closing comments, so I lay over House File 848 for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Committee report.
Thank you, Representative Brown. And we are now to House File 1436. Representative Hamilton, do you have any distance requirements in your bill?
No, sir, but I like yours.
Do we hear a motion to put out here House File 1436? Representative Demmer moves House File 1436 for possible inclusion in the division report. Representative Hamilton, thanks for being here.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Basically, what this bill does is a proposal to change the minimum acre requirement to qualify for the homestead credit. And basically, it'd piggyback off Chair Marquardt's bill, if you will. So I appreciated hearing that discussion also. Current statute states that the parcel needs to consist of a minimum of 40 acres, and you'd find that on line 2.3 of the bill. But we are currently changing or looking at changing that provision only in this proposal. We're not changing any of the other criteria. You'd still have to be an owner and an operator of a farm. You'd have to be a Minnesota resident. You couldn't claim another homestead in Minnesota, and you couldn't live in this bill more than four townships away as far as our proposal. But like I said, I do like yours also. This is only to address the minimum amount of acres. And with me today I have a friend and a small farmer, Larry Leopold from Okabena, that would like to testify to, Mr. Chair.
Very good. So if you would proceed and state your name.
Thank you very much. My name is Larry Leopold. My address is 38748 850th Street, Okabena, Minnesota. As Representative Hamilton said, yeah, I am considered a small farmer. I'm a corn and soybean. We run approximately 490 acres of corn and soybeans. Do a little bit of hay, which is a pretty good commodity right now. And also 120 sow farrow to finish operation. We do everything there is from breeding all the way through marketing in that case, as well as the grain. We also own shares in ethanol plants and own part of a company that its sole purpose is for purchasing shares in value-added energy companies. Just a small family-owned operation. So, and members, Representative Marquardt, thank you for this opportunity to discuss this proposal that I came up with a while back. And as Representative Hamilton said, this amendment will just change the minimum number of acres required for a farm to be included in a special ag homestead. These 40s are becoming less common in, here in Minnesota. Most fence lines have been pulled up, and you're farming from row to row and things like that, so you're seeing more 80s, 160s, even if there isn't a road in between. I know of individuals that are farming the full mile length, which would be, you know, well over 640 acres in one parcel. But these 40s are out there. My parents own one, and I rented from them. My parents have retired to the town, to the community, and have and I've been farming theirs, and we've been qualified for special ag homestead on all of their farms, all but this one. This is part of a farm that's been purchased by my great-grandfather many, many years ago. It was part of a 520-acre plot of farmland, pasture lands, groves, and actually, considering I'm at 490 acres and they're at 520 at the time, that makes me really small. But they were quite inventive in their time, and they had a lot of children. So the work got done very well. This 40 acres is the last 40 acres that has got a continual ownership with the Leopold name on it since great-grandfather came to Minnesota from the old country of Iowa. Yeah, that's right. You are from Iowa, aren't you? And I've got with me this morning, I've got two of my children, Joseph or Austin and Kristen, up there, and my wife Jill, who came along. We're actually en route to a basketball tournament in Wisconsin, so this worked out really well for us to do this today. This not changing the acres won't change their opportunity to own that land. But I'm hoping someday, you know, first I need to be able to purchase it from my parents when they're ready to sell it, and then hopefully that them or their two older siblings that are back at home yet have that opportunity as well. This won't change that at all. It just make them a little bit cheaper to operate in between. The parcel that I'm talking about is 39.85 acres. So we're 0.15 acres off from qualifying for this. I spoke with my county assessor earlier in the week. The taxes for 2007 will be $1,044, or $26.20 an acre. The new rate would be $547. So that 0.15 acres cost my parents $497. Now there's possibility you could buy 2 feet on one side of it from the neighbor and make it 40 acres, things like that. But then they might list it separately, and then I've got two parcels that are too small and it doesn't work, so it doesn't get me anywhere either. This is a bare 40. There's no buildings, there's no services, no utilities, nothing. It's about a quarter mile north of the city limits of the city of Heron Lake. So it may have some value someday as development, but that's a long ways down the road. It's zoned agricultural. It's geographically, even, it sits on the edge of the township, so it gets cut a little bit due to the curvature of the earth. That's where they make up the, you know, the differences in acres, so it gets hurt there a little bit as well. Two reasons I've come before you just to ask you to do this. The first is easy, is to save my parents money. You know, $497 a month or a year, excuse me, is what their savings would be. Secondly, you know, I feel it's fair and equal treatment of similar like pieces of ground. The piece of ground directly across the fence line, which isn't there anymore, was owned, same parcel, back built about, you know, 100 years ago by my great-grandfather, was sold at auction 10 years ago, is part of an 80, that qualifies. And if their CER is the same, their taxes are down lower. So, I mean, they can compete per acre better than I can to the tune of, $12.47 better than I can on the same piece of ground, essentially. So those are my two points. I want, you know, fair and treatment of the same land, save my parents some money, save myself some money. I thank you for your time and your attention. I'd be willing to answer any questions if I can.
Mr. Leopold, thank you for your testimony. Appreciate that. Representative Hamilton.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you know, Mr. Leopold refers to that piece of land as just a bare 40. It's a bare 39.85, yeah. So it doesn't qualify, and that's our whole point here.
I have a question, maybe Representative Hamilton or Mr. Leopold, but you know, when you have, a quarter section there, 160, and then you have a quarter of that, and, you know, with the curvature of the earth, is that how does that work again? Or, I mean, you might lose some there as the latitude line or longitude lines, converge to the poles. But also, on some of these where you might have 40, could there be a utility structure in there that even if it's in the corner of an area, that's going to take off from 40, because, you know, that's just, so you might have the 39 point whatever. I mean, I...
That's right, Mr. Chair.
Is that common? I mean, it's where that would occur?
Well, yes, it could occur. You know, in my opinion, it could occur. And, you know, we're getting more sophisticated to be able to, with GPS and everything else, to map out the total number of acres. You know, in the past, you could refer to that piece of ground as, you know, the bare 40. But like I said, you go out there and you measure it, and it's 39.85, and therefore it doesn't qualify. And so we're just asking to reduce that minimum acres. And we intentionally left this number blank. If you see that, it's blank in the bill. And we intentionally did that. My senator, Senator Vickerman, is the author of this in the Senate, and we had spoke about this. In the bill, it refers multiple times to 20 acres and stuff like that. I was talking to Mr. Leopold, and he said, Rod, why not take it down to 4? I mean, really, what's the difference? And again, it's just he explained the whole history of his family, you know, coming from the old country of Iowa, which is the great state of Iowa. No, I'm just teasing. But my point is, you know, again, it's a family farm. It's a small family farm, you know, and you've been working extremely hard, Mr. Chair, to reduce property taxes. I know Representative Demmer also for ag land. And this is just another hurdle, if you will, for the small farmers out there trying to make a living.
And Representative Hamilton, I think it would be easier, maybe, to change the acreage than to change the longitudinal lines. Although I'm not sure about that. But Representative Mulry,
Mr. Chairman, on that point, wouldn't it be easy if we're losing parcels because they're not technically 40 acres? Wouldn't it be able better to just adjust the law so that took into account if it's a 40 acre parcel, but isn't because of the fact that the lines don't stay straight that they'd have to reduce and not technically knock somebody out on the 40 acres. I would think that could be done.
Could be. Mm-hmm. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have another suggestion.
Great.
I don't like to see the state try to micromanage these things, and maybe we ought to give local assessors some flexibility when it comes to situations like this, rather than forcing people to come down here and ask for a little tweaking of the law. Why not give local officials some opportunity here? I'm thinking of a comparable situation where local boards of equalization can make adjustments on values within a certain range, and maybe we ought to have some kind of provision that would go at this that way and let the local county folks make that decision. Just a suggestion.
Representative Lanning, I think that's an excellent suggestion. Mr. Hagan maybe has some light to shine on this. And what I mean, is there some wiggle room there for...
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is John Hagan. I'm the Assistant Director of the Property Tax Division. I feel like an ogre even testifying against Mr. Leopold's very compelling testimony. He almost won me over. with respect to Representative Lanning's comments about giving local officials more leeway to make local decisions, it's one of those things that sounds like a terrific idea, in my opinion. Regrettably, it seems like we spent most of the last of my career trying to get assessors to do things in the same manner instead of going right. Different directions, and we haven't been particularly successful, I might add, but it's one of those things that sounds like a really good idea. I'm not so sure in policy it is a really good idea. If I might just add on to a little bit about this provision in this proposal, as I said, it's very compelling testimony. The thing to remember about this proposal, it's only for people who don't actually live on their farm. This is for something called actively farming, which is, you oftentimes hear people talk about how complex property tax is, and property tax is like a walk in the park compared to actively farming. This is a flow chart which we've designed to try to work through the actively farming process. I'd be happy to walk you through it, but I'm not smart enough, quite honestly. And your point is well taken. It's so incredibly complex, so I'm so very nervous every time we touch it. When Jenny Eng was Assistant Commissioner, just to use as a prop, a stack of papers this deep showing how many times we'd responded to actually farming questions. That pile has now gotten so big I can't carry it around anymore, so I've gone to the flow chart. With respect to Mr. Leopold's issue of a 39.85 acres, it does seem to me, and if I get back, my staff may correct me on this, but it does seem to me that it would be reasonable to round up to the 40 acres, which would solve this problem. We are going to have problems where somebody has 37 acres or 38 or less acres, which there'll be that same cliff, but we could possibly take care of Mr. Leopold's problems administratively. But I would really urge you to hold the line at 40 acres, more or less.
Okay, I appreciate those comments, Mr. Hagan. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering about, again, not having institutional memory, what the rationale for a minimum 40 acres. I know we have farms, if I remember right, doing my agricultural survey thing, we have farms classified as farms that are much smaller than that with people who don't live there. Why do we have 40 acres for the homestead, and then we can go down to 3 or 6 or 12 acres for something called a farm on the ag census, for example, even though I live in town and I might have a 9-acre parcel that's technically farmland and it's being farmed? Why can't I take my 8 or 9 acres as a farmstead from a policy standpoint, Mr. Chair? Or maybe somebody can answer to that.
Mr. Hagan, can you answer that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can't answer how we got to the 40 acres. I guess it's just kind of a common, a round number. Like the 0.50 was a round number.
You know, like one argument after the other.
on the one hand, as you mentioned, the people who live on their farm could live on 10 acres or more or less and still get the farm. This whole actively farming concept came out of the Red River Valley during the floods of 1991, I believe, where people were displaced from their farms, and it seemed to be a bad idea to make them rebuild in that floodplain where they get displaced again. So the concept is really good, and then it was extended after that to the St. Peter tornado area, which was a little less of a cause and effect than the floods. And then it seemed like such a good idea, it went to everybody. It's always been 40 acres. As I mentioned, it is just an extraordinary administrative nightmare. The 40 acres is working in pretty well. It would frighten me a little bit about all the ramifications that would be involved to reducing that number to 8 or 9 acres, even though it could potentially be a farm.
Representative Hamilton, were you going to...
Well, to this point, I have a question. You know, in the bill on line 1.16 and also 1.24, it refers to parcels that are 20 acres. And again, if nobody can figure out a rational reason why it's the 40 acres, I question why it should stay there. And why not be consistent with some of the other language in the bill of 20 acres?
Thank you. Representative Mullery.
Well, Mr. Chairman, obviously, the 40 is a quarter, and that was usually the smallest that they used to generally farm, and so it made sense. But my question was not only where the lines, should we adjust where the lines are, but what happens, I know, for instance, is it roads that get taken off, or... Sometimes they count against the 40 and sometimes they don't, and I don't understand. It's logical to me to go by the quarter, because that's breaking it down, but then we sometimes say that, oh, they don't qualify because they're not technically a 40. And it's not just the lines not going straight north and south, but it's also, I believe, roads get taken off and other easements maybe or something like that.
Mr. Hagan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulry, of course, like everything else in property tax, the answer is it depends. if it's a state highway, it's an actual taken and the acreage is diminished. Consequently, a 40 acres might become a 30-acre parcel. If it's a township or a county road, it's an easement, not a taking, so the assessor just has the deeded acres of 40 acres and they might subtract an acre for the proximity to the land. So it would still qualify if it's a township or county road. The convergence issue, it creates government lots on the north and west sides of the correction lines that are smaller or occasionally larger than the 40-acre parcel. And that does have some harder situations to correct than a road. But
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chair, having worked in real estate law 30 years, we also know, as you know, that a number of the sections aren't exactly right. And I just know, for instance, we had a 40-acre, a quarter
that was actually technically 38.95 according to the assessor, even though it was mapped out as a quarter-quarter. And I think that's the kind of thing for sure we should take care of and not do this because it's a certain technical kind of a road or a different kind of a road that is there. You lose the qualification because of what kind of road it is. That seems kind of ridiculous.
Well, Representative Hamilton, we're going to just take another minute or two.
Okay,
I think people
okay.
have heard the issues here, and so would you care to make some
sum it up?
Well, first of all, let me ask, is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak for or against House File 1436?
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Paymar.
I just want to know how many landowners would benefit from this change, or is this just for your constituent, Representative Hamilton? I'm just sort of struck by this, my first time on the tax committee, but I sure have a lot of residents in my district that would like me to write specific bills for them to reduce their taxes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to get how many people would actually benefit by the bill.
Representative Hamilton.
Mr. Chair and Representative Paymar, that's a great question. And as you heard testimony from a number of people here, there's probably quite a few people that this would affect. Representative Mullery brought up a perfect example, too. I think this bill was probably put in place when everybody thought the world was flat. But, that's what we're trying to address. You know, take a look at the modern-day equipment to measure acres, et cetera, et cetera. You know, here's one that falls at 39.85, and it doesn't qualify for homestead, even though the land has been in the family for generations. And it's wrong. It's wrong. Will this affect a number of people? It very well could. I don't know what that number is.
Thank you. Well, the chair is going to lay over 1436 for possible inclusion into the vision report. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
We now have a couple bills that deal with our truth and taxation process and Representative Howells, House File 715. Do we hear a motion to put Representative Dietrich moves House File 715 for possible inclusion into the division report? Representative, thank you for being here. Welcome to the division.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Please proceed.
You would like me to speak to the bill. Well, this is a first step. This is to study the truth in taxation bill, and what I'm doing is going to kind of gather facts to what we think is already our knowledge. As a past commissioner and also as a park and rec director, I've taken part in quite a few of these studies. And you have the energy and the dollars to send out the mailings and do the advertisement. And then you bring staff in and you fill up the room. And then you wait for the crowd to come. And the last one I did for Stearns County, or worked with in Stearns County, we had three people come in. And all the neighboring jurisdictions were jealous because they felt that we had a crowd.
Is it?
And we did not. And I think it was about 6,000 a piece. Now we have in the past wanted government to work better and for less. And I think this is one area that we could work better and certainly for less. But we have to first draw an agreement, and that's why we're asking to start with a study to actually see if what we're feeling in central Minnesota is true throughout the state. If it's not, and somebody's doing this, maybe there's a best practice that we should be doing. And then we were going to gather into brainstorming sessions, and we have obviously MICA and the League of Cities and the Association of Counties. They're very excited about making small changes that save a few dollars. Because you get to $1 million when you start multiplying small change. And with me today, I have my friend and a past city council person and through the state of metamorphosis, a very new young county commissioner, Duane Merrick, and he would like to testify.
Mr. Merrick, please proceed.
It's altogether different when I
sit in one of those chairs when I'm out here.
They probably don't want to switch unless there's an election.
I would first of all like to thank you and the members of the committee for giving me this opportunity. As Representative Haas says, and for the record, my name is Dwayne Merrick. I'm a member of the Stearns County Board of Commissioners. Just a little background, I've served as an elected official in local government since 1980. I was with our St. Cloud Township Board for 11 years and then followed by 4 years as a member of the Board of Supervisors. St. Cloud Township merged with the City of St. Cloud. I became a member of the City Council and served there for 10 years. And for the last year, as the Stearns County Commissioner, where I replaced Larry Haas. During that time, I worked for Stearns County most of those years in the Treasurer's Office. I worked for the county for 37 years, and I retired in the year 2000. And so I've been exposed to truth and taxation ever since its inception and have had concerns all along, as I think a lot of local government officials have had. And back in Stearns County, when Representative Haas and I would talk, we would talk about truth and taxation, and so that brings us to the bill that he has introduced. And I have some prepared comments that I'd like to read, Mr. Chair, if that would be okay with you.
Yes.
Okay, the following are my comments on House File 17. It's commonly known as Truth and Taxation. Stearns County Board has unanimously passed a resolution supporting a number of initiatives. One of those is a request that the legislature conduct a cost-benefit analysis of truth and taxation. We would request that the research be done to determine the cost of this either unfunded or underfunded mandate since its adoption in 1988. We question the cost-benefit of truth in taxation statewide since its inception. This money, we feel, could otherwise be used in many other areas such as health care, public safety, education, and so forth. The counties, cities, and school districts who each pay one-third pay the following costs for preparation and mailing of the truth in taxation notices. They pay for computer programming costs, which are usually paid to a third-party vendor for preparation of the notices and related hardware or system costs. And because of the frequent changes in the details of the contents of the notice and the property tax system itself, these are recurring and not just one-time costs. And then we have the staff time to collect the individual jurisdiction's hearing and continuation hearing dates, to coordinate those hearing dates so there's no overlap, and input that data into the computer system. And then we have the staff time to collect the preliminary levy certifications from all the jurisdictions. We have to input that data into the computer system. We need to verify all the input data. We need to verify that the levy input is within current limits and in accord with the current bond covenants. We certify the tax rates to the adjoining county auditors for joint counties, school districts, and other jurisdictions that cross county lines. And then verification of the accuracy of the preliminary tax rates, tax calculations, and hearing schedules. We have to print the truth in taxation notices. The preparation of those notices for mailing, the stuffing of envelopes and placing the appropriate postage on those envelopes or carbonless forms in the alternative, and adding any additional information that individual jurisdictions elect to include, doing any pre-sort to reduce postage costs, and delivering the notice to the Postal Service. A third-party vendor frequently does this. And then we have the postage for mailing of the notice, and I think most of us are aware that postage rate is going up shortly. We have additional staff time that results when individuals get their truth in taxation notice. Some individuals look at that as a tax bill and send in a payment, and so we wind up, you know, using staff time and sending that money back. And just 4 months later, we actually send out the actual bill. Each county, school district, and larger cities incur costs for placing an ad in a newspaper of general circulation of the required truth in taxation information and hearing notice. Each jurisdiction required to hold a truth in taxation hearing incurs additional staff costs for preparation of materials for the councils or boards, as well as the public. In addition, staff time and costs are incurred for those staff who are present at the jurisdiction's truth in taxation hearings. At a subsequent hearing, the affected jurisdiction must adopt their final levies and certify them again to the county auditor. Each affected jurisdiction then subsequently certifies compliance with the truth and taxation requirements. Following the conclusion of the hearings and the final levy certifications, county staff must verify final certified levies do not exceed the preliminary truth and taxation levies with certain exceptions. And I've got some numbers here that our Stearns County Auditor, Randy Schreifels, put together for me about what's happening in Stearns County.
Commissioner, could you just really summarize that?
Okay,
kind of,
sure.
We're running, we've got three more bills yet.
Okay,
and
sure.
So you just kind of summarize those costs.
All right. The cost for 2006 was $29,408. That was for postage, TNT notices, employee time programming, and that doesn't include the cost for the TNT meeting itself, which in Stearns County amounted to $2,700 last year. 18 out of 30 cities were conducting those hearings last year in Stearns County, and 15 out of the 16 school districts. If we take the 16 years from 91 to 2006 in Stearns County, that amounted to $430,700. And as a starting point, if you'd want to just, and I don't know if this, it's certainly not an accurate number, but if you took that times 87 counties over 16 years, it'd be $37,470,900, which is a pretty big piece of change. The TNT notices don't include information on special assessments or referendums that were passed in the fall elections, because the final statements are mailed out in the fall, in March of the next year, and they include that information. As Representative Haas said, Stearns County has about 2 to 3 people at their meetings. Stearns County has a lot of financial information available on their website. Just a couple of additional items. You might want to take a look at the Pioneer editorial on Thursday, January 26th. It says local governments have valid arguments over the required truth in taxation public hearings to allow taxpayers to question officials on their proposed taxes and budgets for the next year. While the legislature enacted the law to ensure greater public access to final decisions, the truth in taxation hearings haven't fulfilled that role. I have two emails, one from our city finance director, John Norman. He says public testimony at the city's TNT meetings has been very minimal over the years. Also, a number of public that did testify was confused about the purpose and was actually complaining about their valuation increase, which is not the point of the TNT hearings. Over the past 10 years, we have had a number of years where there was no one testifying, and the overall have probably averaged 1 to 2 people.
Commissioner, could you summarize, could you finish here in about 30 seconds?
I will.
If you would, please.
The last email that I have was from our superintendent of schools, who says we've had zero to three persons attend our sessions. Last year, our number was zero. In 5 years, we have had one person ask to speak or testify. I'm certainly available to answer questions if you like. Thank you very much for your time.
I appreciate the background very much and the detail. I mean, I think we got a flavor for the cost and all the processes. Thank you so much. Representative Earhart.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would suggest that this isn't all about money. You need to give the public an opportunity to observe firsthand, front up, and talk back to you when they don't like what you're doing. I'm going to give you some institutional memory real quick. My first couple of years here, 12 to 14 years ago, the city of St. Paul was under, people only come out to these things when there's stress on their property taxes. They had hearings in St. Paul where they were overrunning the schools. I went to one as an observer on Lexington in 94. There must have been 1,000 people there, and they were going to lynch some of the council members. That's about how tough it was. I remember going to my city council chambers that were overflowing, 200 to 300 people were there protesting, and the city actually lowered its budget, its levy. And there was a lot of stress going on there. Well, it died down. Coleman came in and never raised his property taxes for the last 100 years or whatever he did here in St. Paul. So that settled down, and there hasn't been stress. Now that he got some stress going again, so you maybe will see some people coming out to these things.
Thank you. Mr. Matthews, did you have some comments?
Very briefly.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Joe Matthews with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and just to echo their comments, the Association of Minnesota Counties is very excited about looking at this, not just about the money issue, as you said, Representative Earhart, but also to find some efficiencies and maybe make this a little more meaningful for the public. It's kind of a shame we think that the public isn't more engaged, and it is our position that we'd like to find a way to use the new technology like the internet or other items that might possibly supplement what's going on and maybe reduce costs in the long run, but also make it a little more effective.
Representative,
Mr. Chair, very quickly.
And that's exactly why we're not jumping in here with both feet, is because we want to go slow enough that we actually find out what's the cost of truth and taxation. If you want to know about the cost of government, you also have to know about the cost of truth and taxation. Then we want to build from there, how do we keep transparency? How do we make it better at a reduced cost? And that will be running parallel to this program.
Thank you much. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, Representative Haas, in this study, if we can make sure that the Department of Revenue also looks at public participation through cable television. I know when I was on the Planning Commission, I was surprised by the number of people that watched the proceedings of city events and county events via television, and though they're not there in person, they certainly are participating in their home, sometimes yelling at their television. So if that could be part of the study, I know that would be difficult, but maybe a survey could achieve that goal of how many people are watching the proceedings from home and taking in the information at that point, too.
Mr. Chair, I would resonate that also. TV has really put open government out for counties and cities that have it. It really has done a number because they know who you are and they can watch you or turn you off real quick. With that, you can turn us off. We'll say thank you.
Haas, I appreciate your efforts to this, and I think any study here can't just look at the cost, but also has to look at how local governments can work harder to get people involved. I know when schools go out to sell referendums, they don't just wait for people to come to them. They go out and they go to the Lions Club and out to the chamber and various groups because they want to get the information out to sell. And I do think that, as a former mayor, that local governments can do a better job also of trying to get people to these meetings. You know, it's kind of easy to say, well, they're not working, it's a waste of time, but how much outreach are we really doing? And it shouldn't just take a crisis, as Representative Earhart mentions. I mean, it should be, this is huge. This sets priorities. When you set the budget, it's the most important thing cities and counties and local units do. And I do think there's some ways, and I think any study here should also look at how can we get residents more involved, but what can local governments do that they're not doing? Internet, television, whatever, going out, meeting at a senior citizen center rather than City Hall for their meeting and scheduling. I think you could improve that too. So with that, the chair will lay over House File 715 for possible inclusion in the report. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
And I'm going to turn this over to Representative Browning.
The next bill we have for consideration is House File 1769. Representative Marquardt, would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 1769.
Representative Marquardt, please present your bill. In the interest of time, please, I'm going to have everybody take a look at the clock. We've got about 3 minutes apiece for the next three bills.
Madam Chair, the House File 1769 allows for joint meetings, and it was a bill I presented last year, so some of you might have heard this, but what it would do, it's entirely voluntary, but what would happen in, it doesn't include the metropolitan area, although it could, and we left that out just because of the number of cities and how school districts overlap and so forth, but certainly could include the metropolitan areas. But the county, totally voluntary, would send out a memo to all cities within its county of 500 or more, because cities under 500 do not have to have the public meetings. And what they would do, if they wanted to do that, school districts and cities, is they could meet. And the bill sets up a format of how this joint hearing could go. First 30 minutes would be for the county. Next 30 minutes, and you'd probably meet in a school where you'd have several rooms, but let's say you had five cities. In room 206 would be Dilworth and Moorhead and whatever the cities. You'd, at that point, the next half hour, go to your city meetings. Then the next half hour, go to your school district meetings. And then at the very end, and the bill sets a maximum of 3 hours for this meeting, so you'd have whatever's left, you would then come together. But it would be a one-stop shop where, you know, right now if you get that public notice form, you got three different dates you have to go, three different nights, you got to sit and wait. And also, many times when you're at one local unit of government, they're saying, well, it's because this happened, where if you could get them all in one room at the end. Now, someone suggested we should also say that state legislators would have to also be there also. And that is not in the bill. But at any rate, it's a way to make things more transparent. I think citizens, actually, if it was a one night, and we set the date up for, I think, the first Thursday in December, and that's when the county date is usually set. So it would be for that. Of course, they could not set the final levy. They'd still go back to their own entities to set the final levy. But I'll stand for questions. There's a few more details, but that's the gist of it.
Representative Anderson. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be brief. I'm glad you brought this issue up. Actually, I had a constituent raise this to me. It's more difficult, you know, because I'm in Hennepin County and there's multiple cities there, but it is something that I'd like to look at even in the metro area. I'm glad you brought this issue forward.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, and we should work together on that. I would love to include the metropolitan area if we could make it work. So.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we need to be creative in this area, and I think you've started towards that. My thought is, you know, if we allow pilots that people can apply for different approaches and set some basic standards they have to meet, rather than sort of prescribe it, because I think most taxpayers, when they come, you know, it's like, I can take a 10% increase, but I can't take 29%. I mean, and they don't really care about which jurisdiction it is sometimes as much as they really want to make that statement about, I want to see all of you together helping us bring this to something we can afford. And so, I mean, I think that the idea of bringing it together and having the citizens have a chance to do it and not have lots of meetings where nobody shows up, and I think has some merit. But I think the process that you have may work better in some communities than others, and I think just having a lot of flexibility and some experimentation might be a nice thing to do.
Thank you.
Okay, any testifiers from the audience? Any other comments, Representative Marquardt?
That is it. I'd be willing to work with any members on this, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay, we'll take one more. Demo, this will be the last question.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Marquardt, I do think this has a lot of merit. The one thing I was learning about the time frame of 30 to 60 minutes, might want to set a maximum and maybe leave the minimum at open in case it is very short.
Thank you.
Thank you. I lay over House File 1769 for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Committee report.
Thank you, Representative Brown. If Representative Olin and Representative Liebling would both come forward for House File 1368 and 1777, they are both county program aid increases. And we hear a motion to move 1368. Representative Lincheski moves House File 1368 for possible inclusion. And we can take one at a time. We can hear them both. Oh, can we do it? Yeah, Representative Lincheski moves House File 1777 for possible inclusion. Representative Olin, you're first on the list. If you would present your bill.
Okay, my bill, I had some rhetoric I was going to use, but obviously with the time, I'm not going to go into the background history because you all are well aware of the background history. What this bill basically does is puts $20 million into county local program aid. This $20 million would put us at the same level, basically, as we were before we had to make the cuts in 2003. So all we'd be doing is getting back to where we were. My bill basically puts $10 million of that into local government need aid and $10 million into tax-based equalization aid. So I would split it equally between those two categories. And then there would be, for years after 2008, there would be an inflation factor that in our bill works in a 2.5% minimum with a maximum of 5%. And with that, I will not make any further comments, and I don't know if you want to take my witnesses or listen to Representative Liebling first, and then we can do the witness.
Okay. Representative Liebling, why don't you tell us what the differences are in your bill from 1368?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Chair, members, I have with me today Keith Carlson from the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and I'm going to, this was really a bill that came from him, and I'm going to let him, if it's okay with you, take the seat here and explain the difference.
All right. Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'll address the chairman's question, what's the difference between the two bills. Basically, the bills are very similar in that they increase county program aid. In the case of Representative Holland's bill and Senate file 1368 by 20 million, in the case of Representative Liebling's bill by $20.5 million. So they are nearly identical in their amount. Both bills provide for the indexing for the appropriation for county program aid, reverting to the practice that existed prior to 2003. But there's some minor differences in that Representative Olin's bill provides that there's a 2.5% floor and a 5% ceiling, while Representative Liebling's bill has no floor or ceiling. Finally, the distribution of the dollars, there are really two pieces of county program aid, one that's referred to as tax-based equalization and the other that's referred to the needs portion of the aid formula. Senator or Representative Olin's bill splits the money evenly between those two sides. Representative Liebling's bill basically approximates the distribution of the dollars as they existed in 2003 when there were three predecessor programs, HACA, Criminal Justice Aid, and Family Preservation Aid. It puts an amount that approximates that what was previously coming from the latter two into the need sides of the formula and then from the HACA side into the tax-based equalization. But basically, those are the differences. And regardless, I'm here. Commissioner Joe Harris from Dakota County, the president of our organization, are also here to endorse both bills.
Thank you much. Mr. Matthews, did you have some comments? And we'll take questions from the division.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the interest of time, I'll be extremely brief. AMC obviously supports an increase in county program aid, and I passed out a couple charts. The first one just shows kind of the history of the appropriation, and it just shows where we took a hit. Over the past couple of years with the budget deficits, counties have forgone about $242 million in county program aid. And that comes on top of all the cuts in human services, which were about another $200 million, plus public safety and a number of other areas. So this is a small piece when you're looking at property tax relief, but it's a very important one. We feel this is something that really gets down to the root of the problem, which is a state partnership with the counties for all the services that we're mandated to provide. The second chart, I just want to highlight quickly as well. Here you can see this middle line, it's got the squares attached to it, shows you what our property taxes have done in the last few years. You'll notice that the percent change has been pretty flat from 2002 until 2005. The last couple of years it started to curve up, and you can see that's driven by declining county revenues over the last few years, which is the triangular line. And that's really been driven by reductions in state aids to counties, which is obviously the bottom line with the X's. So I'd just like to say that, you know, we've been very responsible as local governments. We tried to use property taxes as a last resort. And this is money that really does trickle down directly to the citizens of Minnesota all across the state. And we honestly think this is one of the most important pieces in the property tax relief area. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you much. Any questions from members? Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair, and to the authors, I actually think you're dreaming way, way too small, given the factors. I mean, if we're serious as a committee about trying to reduce property taxes, one of the fastest growing components is going to be county costs, just because the federal government, with its deficit, is just really slashing its partnership on all the programs that counties are mandated to provide. They can't change the formulas of who they let on and FIP. They can't change which senior citizen they serve, the community corrections costs because we've lengthened the probation time, et cetera, are going up. And this is the largest part of everyone's property tax bill is their county taxes. And so while the chart here with the line shows cuts, it doesn't show the cuts in the federal. And I think as we're putting together a bigger strategy towards, you know, stabilizing property taxes, we really have to have some more sophisticated projections of what's happening there.
Thank you. Any Representative Earhart?
Commissioner Harris could address that if you'd like him to quickly. The question Representative Loeffler had.
Okay. Well, I think we know what the federal cuts. I think we're aware of. I mean, we do know, and I know that governor has some one-time money, and you know, that's an area we're going to need to look at. So
Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that I heard Representative Lockhart say the largest portion was the county of your object bill. I think it's the schools, unless something has changed.
No, it is the county now.
It is not county.
Prior to our takeover in 2001, it was the schools. Okay. But yeah, the county is actually the largest share now. Representative Limchesky.
And I have a thought. This actually relates really well to Representative Marquardt's bill, and that is getting residents to understand that if you had these joint hearings, folks kind of focus on the piece that they're dealing with at the moment, and often legislators are very driven by this LGA debate, and they're looking at the LGA debate, and actually they would get more delivery of property tax relief to their residents by putting more money into County 8. Yeah, absolutely. Now, if you're a city, you know, you don't want to do that because you're the mayor and you're running the town. It's not changing what you're doing in the property tax component. But down to the bottom line of the taxpayer, you actually can, when you look at LGA and County 8 and everything going on in the system, you can buy more property tax relief by giving more County 8. I think the best feature in both of these bills, Mr. Chair, and I think the most expensive over the long term, and this committee has to wrestle with this because it's a tails question, but it's, to me, the most important piece is the indexing. And that is the problem. There is no indexing, so we have to keep making these arguments. I heard Representative Loeffler say, you know, dream bigger. I actually would agree on dreaming bigger, but maybe not in the appropriation or the money on to the aid. Rather, dream for the index, because that's the thing that gets the counties there over the long haul, and I think the counties would agree with that. So I think there's a lot of competing issues here, but my understanding is, as we saw in the most recent forecast, we have a tails problem in the next biennium, and so to index gets even harder. But I'm just delighted that Representative Liebling and Representative Olin are addressing the inflation component through the index. I appreciate that.
Thank you. Any closing comments from Representative Olin or Representative Liebling?
Just a quick closing comment. Yeah, I agree 100% with what Representative Limchesky was saying. I agree with what Representative Loeffler was saying. And I realize the numbers would be ideal to be bigger, but I think realistically this is where we're going to be. And realistically, if we could put in that inflation factor or what indexing, we're way ahead of where we are right now.
Representative Liebling?
Right. Well, I appreciate those comments from Representative Limchesky, and just thank you all for hearing the bill this morning.
Anyone from the audience that would care to speak for or against this bill? And if you could keep that to about 30 seconds, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Joe Harris, a Dakota County Commissioner, and I'm also President of the Minnesota Inter-County Association, and I'm here today to support these two bills, and I think the committee has a grasp of what House File 1368, bringing back the program aids and providing indexing for inflationary in the future. We certainly agree with that, and then it was already discussed about how the counties are having to deal with and looking forward to the federal reductions and audits. The governor has put some money in his bill, $40 million. Certainly that doesn't cover it all, and we're going to be, if those federal cuts, if and when they do get here and the audits get here, we're going to be under siege. And you were just recently talking about truth and taxation, and we will have 1,000 people at our meetings. So we certainly need the state to be a partner, and I want to remind the state that and the committee members that it's time for the state to step up and do its share, because in many cases the state of Minnesota is the second lowest level in funding child protection. And I mean, I don't think the state of Minnesota wants to be at the bottom of that list. And I think the state needs to step in and help the counties in providing funding for the services and the programs that we have to provide. So thank you very much.
Thank you much. Anyone else from the audience care to speak for or against? Representative Earhart, did you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would think that we ought to also think strongly about a big increase in the circuit breaker. Once again, the people that are affected by this are not here. The civilians that are paying the taxes, all we've got is the institutions here telling us they want more money. And we forget that the people that need it are probably not going to necessarily get the relief by dumping more money into the counties.
I appreciate those comments, Representative. So, with that, the chair will lay over House File 1368 and House File 1777 for possible inclusion into the omnibus division report. Thank you so much. Good luck to Hayfield tonight. And next Friday, we are going to recess after a normal meeting, come back at noon, and finish off a mess of bills. So try to plan that. Have a great weekend. We are adjourned.